Order here. The day is Monday, March 2nd. Welcome back to our subcommittee. It's been about a year here. What we're looking to do here in the next couple of weeks is hold four or five committee meetings. What we have scheduled so far is at the 2nd today, this Wednesday the 4th, next Monday the 9th, and then next Wednesday the 11th, all at 4 p.m., hopefully in this room. We'll do our best to keep you posted on any changes. I know with the limited capital space and loss of a couple of committee hearing rooms, it's going to be tight over the next couple of weeks as we work to deadlines. But as we've done in the past, what we'd like to do is build our game and fish, I should say our fish and wildlife omnibus bill in committee, and we'll plan on having some overviews today from DNR as our agenda outlines, and then we'll start hearing individual member bills this Wednesday and into next week with the intention of building our omnibus bill from that point forward. So with that said, we would like to get into our agenda here today, and we have an overview from DNR on the deer population management effort. And if we could call testifiers to the table, please. Well, welcome to the Subcommittee on Fish and Wildlife. If you could, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul T. Lander, Wildlife Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources. And with me, Steve Merchant, our Populations Manager for DNR as well.
Welcome both.
Thank you.
I understand you're working off of a PowerPoint presentation today. You have handouts in our packets, members.
Yep, there was a handout for committee members there, and then the presentation should be displayed behind us. Hopefully we're not blocking.
You are blocking it, so maybe if I could instruct both of you to move to your right, one seat. All right.
There you go.
Perfect.
That
I think
we've
got plenty of microphones. Should work for us. Thank you.
Okay, well, Steve and I are going to do kind of a tag team presentation here today and talk about the deer population management system that we have in Minnesota. So while I wait for the first slide, it's kind of strange. The first slide that we had planned for didn't display for some reason.
Okay. I'm guessing it may be a big file. So we have a copy in our handouts.
Yeah,
if
you look at the handout, it shows the deer harvest in Minnesota from 1918 through 2014. And you can see after the turn of the century there with the era of logging and so on, it opened up a lot of forest cover into better deer habitat, and the population began to increase over time. There were some severe winters in the mix there. We had closed seasons back in 1950 and most recently back in 1971. And then following the 71 season closure and a change in harvest management, the population steadily increased, as you can see. And then in 95, 96, 96, 97, we had two back-to-back severe winters, which brought the population down pretty dramatically. And then it was followed by a continued increase until we hit peak deer populations and harvest in 2003. Then we went through a goal-setting process in the mid-2000s and moved populations downward toward goal, which accounts for some of that decline. And then that was followed by last winter and the winter before, which were severe winters, at least in northern Minnesota, and the population declined further. And then the next slide, I just want to bring your attention to an article that showed up in a magazine, Hunting Magazine, 2013 season, where they were hunters dissatisfied across the country in terms of deer harvest and deer seasons. They'd gotten accustomed to previous decade and I guess had their expectations set on what they'd experienced then and were kind of unhappy with deer levels in that 2013 season. But I also want to talk about some of the better things with deer seasons in Minnesota or deer populations. And if you look at deer disease, the slide in front of you here talks about chronic wasting disease. Most incidents of chronic wasting disease in captive cervid farms depopulated. In fact, all we have at this point. There was one case of CWD detected in wild deer in Minnesota in the southeast, but there were no follow-up identifications. So at this point, we don't think we have any CWD in wild deer in Minnesota. Also, bovine tuberculosis occurred in northwest Minnesota in the mid-2000s, has been either eradicated or brought down to undetectable levels. So things look good on that. And then the next slide, epizootic hemorrhagic disease, or EHD, has been found in neighboring states, but not in wild deer in Minnesota. There has been a couple of occurrences in cattle in southwest Minnesota. out in recent years, but nothing in wild deer. While the states like the Dakotas experienced dramatic declines in deer from EH, in deer populations from EH.
So, Mr. Thielander, if you could just pull your microphone a little closer to you. I think you're cutting in and out a little bit.
Certainly.
All right, thank you.
Welcome. And the deer habitat situation is good currently in Minnesota. Got legacy funding for forest and grassland management and acquisition. With the passage of the legacy amendment in 2008, that's equated to more public land open to hunting. Timber harvest, especially on state and county lands, remains strong, with nearly 3 million cords of wood harvested annually, which equates to about 150,000 acres of early successional habitat created annually. So good things on the scene with forest management. Now I'm missing a slide again. So our PowerPoint's not working as planned here. So if you go to your next slide, which shows Minnesota firearms deer license sales, and this is, again, the period from 1918 through last year, 2014. You can see again how the license sales have changed over time. And I mentioned the decline in deer populations following the two severe winters in the 90s and then the two recent ones. And license sales dipped about 4% each of those periods, but overall license sales remain strong. So that's the point at which I'm going to end and then turn it over to Steve to continue the PowerPoint.
All right, well, thank you. And sir, again, if you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Steve Merchant. I'm the Wildlife Population Manager for the Department of Natural Resources. Okay, I'm not getting anything here. Okay, I think we're just going to abandon our, for some reason we're having technical problems.
That's right, we can work off of the handouts.
Sure. Again, displays the Minnesota's deer harvest from 1918 to 2014. Paul mentioned those areas. What I'd really like to have you look at there are the two areas that are encompassed in those boxes. The one on the left is that period of two back-to-back severe winters in 1996 and 97. And then what you see this year, following the back-to-back winters of 2013, we had very similar situations where those winters had a pronounced effect on our deer population. You can also see, though, in 2003, where we had record high deer numbers, preceding that year, really, the DNR became concerned about a burgeoning deer population and some of the negative effects that deer population was having on Minnesota, in particular the northern forest. So we initiated some very aggressive harvest regulations in those times to bring that deer population down. In 2005 and 2006, we had a very public process where we met with deer hunters and other stakeholders. In a good part of the state, there were recommendations to lower the deer population. Also on this slide, it shows sort of we've come to learn that harvest, when we go below 150,000, there's a large amount of dissatisfaction. That's certainly not an acceptable harvest level. But what exactly is that sustainable harvest level that people will be happy with is a little bit uncertain. Our experience shows that when deer harvests are at or above that 200,000 mark, deer hunters seem pretty happy.
Sure.
Next page, please. This just shows deer harvest by the decade. And what I wanted to demonstrate here is that this half decade that we're in right now is kind of the half decade of the disgruntled hunter that Paul mentioned. Even in that time, though, we still have harvests averaging about 180,000 deer, which from a historical point of view is really quite a high deer harvest. It's only been exceeded in the decade of the 90s and the first decade of the 2000s. So certainly we agree and understand that the current the harvest that we've had the last few years are unacceptably low, and we certainly believe that there's room to grow that deer population. Next slide, please. I wanted to demonstrate here that if you look at the red bars, it shows buck harvest over time, and buck harvest is a good trend indicator of the overall deer population. And as you can see, that's been relatively stable, certainly down the last couple of years, but not down dramatically. The buck harvest this past year is about 33% off of what the all-time high buck harvest of the early 2000s. The yellow bars represent the antlerless deer harvest. And you can see in those years following 2003 where we did have very liberal regulations in an effort to lower deer populations, we were harvesting a lot of antlerless deer. That harvesting of those antlerless deer, again, was to lower the deer population to meet our goals. You can see where we started to get a little bit more conservative as deer populations declined. And I just wanted to point out in the bar at the for 2014, you can see how small that antlerless deer harvest was from a statewide perspective. And that really kind of compared to how large those bars were in the early 2000s. And that small bit of antlerless harvest really shows how conservative we were last deer hunting season. And how it's kind of set the stage, if you will, if we get some cooperation from Mother Nature and the winter, which, in fact, we are getting this year, we really should. We're poised to see a rebound in our deer population. Next slide just takes a little bit closer look at last year's deer season. If you look at the 100 series, that's sort of northern Minnesota. The color that's in yellow was where we had bucks only this year, so you were not able to take an antlerless deer. But in all of the 100 deer permit areas, we saw a buck harvest off about 22%. So that kind of indicates the extent of that winter loss that we saw. And you see the antlerless harvest was off 64%. And again, that's more of a reflection of just how conservative the season was. Most people there could not legally harvest an antlerless deer, but certainly saw a very significant decline in deer harvest in that part of the state. It's a little bit different story in the 200 series and the 300 series. Within the 200 series, buck harvest was just off a single percentage, indicating a fairly stable population. And yet, the antlerless harvest was off 26%, again, indicating the very conservative season regarding antlerless harvest. And then if you look at the 300 series, we actually saw a growth in the buck harvest and just a very small decrease in the antlerless deer harvest. And this is kind of a reflection of our 2012 goal-setting teams, which actually resulted in us persons wanting a slight increase in deer populations in that Zone 3, and it appears as that we're on our way to accomplishing that. The next page shows our deer management system. Much has been said about our deer model. Mainly, I just wanted to point out that our deer management system is much more than just a deer model. We have a real solid deer management system here in Minnesota. Our system is based upon the best scientific information and methodologies that are available. We've made considerable investments over the last several decades to conduct both ecological research and social science research that sort of lets us know what's going on within our deer population and how our deer hunters and landowners and other members of our community feel about deer and deer hunting. We're really lucky here in Minnesota that we have mandatory deer harvest registration. So we have really good long-term data sets on how many deer are harvested, and that's really valuable information because our harvest data is really, particularly that buck harvest, is really really our best indication of what that population is doing overall. You know, I just want to say that our modeling that perhaps you've heard a lot about, you know, the model itself doesn't make any decisions. It's just a tool that we use as managers to help us make those decisions. We're using the harvest information. We're doing aerial deer surveys where applicable. So we're looking at many factors other than just that model. Some would make you believe that the model is sort of this rote process, and whatever the model spits out, that's what we do. It's really, there's much more to it than that. I will say that we have gone through a pretty extensive internal review of our deer model, and we have made some changes for this year. Primarily, we're using the Winter Severity Index statewide, where we just used to use that in the northern part of the state. We've also done some improvements of just how we import data into our model to try to alleviate some human errors involved in handling that data. And then we've also moved to a system that's called a stochastic model versus a deterministic model. And that those are just some kind of fancy words for the stochastic model builds in some uncertainty that biological systems have. So we've done that to give people a better understanding of that these projections that we give are just projections. We really don't know how many deer there are in Minnesota. Our model tells us a reasonable range of what the deer population could be given the data that we have. And with that, that's the conclusion of our...
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Merchant, and thank you, Mr. Thielander. If you could just say a little bit more about, I guess, what we've done in the past to address follow-up and improving deer populations following difficult winters. And I know that there is some talk of feeding, and obviously this winter is not as harsh as last winter. But if you could just talk a little bit about what sorts of tools you have at your disposal.
Right. Our primary tool is our antlerless deer harvest system. And following severe winters like we saw in 96 and 97 and again 2014, is that we go very conservatively. We essentially, a significant portion of the state becomes buck only, so no one can legally harvest an antlerless deer. And those antlerless deer is really the reproductive potential of your deer herd. So if we don't allow any harvest of those, that is what results in that quick rebound if, in fact, we get a break in the winter weather, which we're experiencing now. So that's our primary tool, and it's worked very well, as demonstrated at really severe winters of 96 and 97.
All right. Now, down in my neck of the woods, from Red Wings, I have this Series 300 area here moving to the southeast. I hear from a lot of folks who say that there's plenty of deer out there. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about the precision with which you're able to count deer and estimate population changes and what sorts of things might be on the horizon in terms of having, I guess, more accuracy in predicting deer populations.
Mr. Chair... senators, I'm not a statistician, so it's a little bit difficult for me to address the precision issue. We certainly don't want to give the perception that counting deer is a precise undertaking. We really do use methodologies that are state of the art, but even with that, the precision levels are certainly not, they're less than ideal, let's put it that way. And I don't know if I could ask my colleague Lou Cornicelli here if he wants to weigh in on this question. You want to hear what Dr. Cornicelli, has to say about precision?
Sure. Let's get into the statistics a little bit here. And welcome to the committee. If you don't mind, just stating your name for the record.
Sure. For the record, Lou Cornicelli, Minnesota DNR.
All right. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, we evaluate populations, as Mr. Merchant indicated, a couple of ways. One, we use harvest to track trends, as Steve explained. When we calibrate deer permit areas, we do it one of two ways. We do it in the farmland, which think about the desert southwest corn belt. We do that on the ground using something called distance sampling. In other areas of the state, including the area you are, we use aerial surveys with helicopters, and a lot of that is snow-dependent, and this year we're not getting any of them done because there's no snow. But we tend to try and select random square-mile blocks within a permit area and stratify the entire permit area based on habitat type. So a block that has, a section of corn ranks lower than a block that has a section of woods. So we fly a representative sample of all those sections and then extrapolate that out to the whole permit area. We couldn't afford to fly an entire permit area because they're too big. And then our ultimate goal is to become between 20% of the true population 90% of the time. So that's our goal, is to be come within 90% or 20% of the population plus or minus 90% of the time we do the surveys. And again, it's not a perfect methodology, but it's pretty standard for states that actually do this kind of trend monitoring. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's really helpful. I'm just curious, do other states, take into account, any stories on the ground or engagement thereof, or is it really a matter of aerial, overviews?
Mr. Chair, states vary. Some states don't do anything. Some do aerial surveys. Some do ground-based surveys, but a lot of them don't do anything. If you think about states like Iowa and going south, they don't typically have the snow cover to do aerial surveys because they are so snow-dependent. So if you're not a northern state like Minnesota, Michigan, or Wisconsin, you can't do aerial surveys. And to my knowledge, Wisconsin doesn't. I don't know about Michigan.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And I guess one follow-up question I have, and members, if you'd like to jump in here, please. But just if you could just outline a little bit of the history with the antler point restriction, how that plays into our population estimates and where we're at, in southeastern Minnesota versus the rest of the state. I feel like there may be another layer of discussion here relative to these numbers, if you don't mind just speaking briefly to that.
Mr. Chair.
Which everyone would like, yes.
Sure. I'm the stand-in, so I apologize.
Right.
Mr.
Doing
Chair,
great.
Members, we probably tracked leading up to, I ran the big game program at the time, so I know a fair bit about the issue, but prior to implementing antler point restrictions in 2010, we had collected a lot of data on buck age structures and certainly our population monitoring. And it doesn't play too much into population monitoring because the model that we use is basically an accounting model. So it's deer out equals deer, plus deer born minus other mortalities equals the deer population. So we know that by measuring the buck population through harvest rates, we can make an estimate of the number of bucks that are in the population. So when we don't harvest them, and because there's very little overwinter mortality typically in the southeast, we've saved those deer. So they're additive to the population going forward. But the key point with antler point restrictions in relation to deer populations is that in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter because we manage deer by taking antlerless deer. The buck component is really not that important in terms of overall population size because whether you have one buck in the population or 1,000, all the females get bred anyway. So you could remove a very high percentage of the male population and still have all the females bred, and that population goes up, which is kind of how we managed deer in the 70s. So the antler point restriction functionally, with the exception of putting increased pressure on female deer, which it's designed to also do, it doesn't have an overall giant impact on the population other than driving some harvest into the female side, which it's done. But when we do the hunter choice designation, it kind of changes behavior, so it washes out to some extent. So it does two things. It saves bucks that don't necessarily mean much in the end in terms of overall size, and it does put a little bit more harvest pressure on females.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, sir. Mm-hmm. If there's no additional questions at this stage, we'd like to call up another testifier for this portion of the discussion. Mr. Engwall, if you don't mind approaching the testifier's desk. And thank you both, gentlemen.
Well,
sir, welcome to our committee. If you don't mind just stating your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Craig Engwell. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association.
Sure.
Just to follow the DNR's testimony, we've had productive meetings with DNR recently, and I'll speak to that. But the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has testified before to the House, and now we are formally on record as supporting an annual deer harvest in the neighborhood of about 225,000 deer. There's not magic to that exact number. Where we base this number off of is the last 15-year average, which is about a little over 220,000. And if you look at the 25-year average, it's about 208,000 deer annually, and that's based on DNR's harvest numbers. It was stated that the current harvest, even at that 139,000 level where it is relatively high. I just think the context of 1918 today doesn't really work, because we didn't have 100,000 deer hunters till post-World War II. We didn't have 250,000 till the mid-60s. So those numbers, we think a 25-year window is a much fairer window to look at in seeking a harvest level. We do think that the very conservative season that the DNR implemented in 2014 was appropriate. We've asked the DNR to do that again, which they have agreed to for 2015. The herd is low. It can rebound quickly, as Mr. Merchant stated. I believe it went from 145,000 post-97 to the 290,000 in 03. So with good weather, conservative harvest, we can grow the herd back. And so our resolution calls for DNR to implement a plan that would grow the herd back by 2019 to about 225,000 as our goal. One of the issues that arises, as was testified, was how DNR makes projections, the model, those things. It's been very hard for us and other interested hunters to look at the data. It's data intensive when the state is, it is necessarily divided into 128 different permit areas to deal with the situation in Red Wing versus where I live in northern Minnesota, which is vastly different. And we understand that. But because we haven't been able to look at those numbers closely area by area, we focus on the statewide harvest goal, because that's an accumulation of those things. After meeting with Commissioner Landwehr and others on Friday, we have a commitment from DNR that they will move forward with the deer plan that will look at the big picture, and in that plan we'll look at setting a statewide harvest goal. And they also look at trying to disseminate data very soon at that permit area level, so that we can see how those decisions are made at that 128 permit area level. Because we are in the midst of a goal setting process right now, and still it's hard for participants in that process to really glean all the factors that are being considered. So we think that's very positive. We're very pleased after our meeting with the commissioner and others on Friday that those things will move forward. And we understand that with the goal setting in process, that to implement that deer planning process can wait till after that. But we definitely want to be involved in that and see how that plays out. There was talk of the 2006 goal setting process and a call for reduction, and we understand that. We don't claim that 290,000 annual harvest is sustainable, and a reduction was appropriate, but I would point out that the current harvest levels have far exceeded the reduction called for in that 2006 goal setting process. So we'd like to work with DNR and the other hunters to try to flatten the peaks and valleys that we've had between 97, which I believe the harvest was about 145 or there, somewhere around there, the 290, and where we are today at 139. There are factors that we can't control. We can't control the weather. There are predator issues, but we can control the number of permits that are issued per permit area. And that's where we want to be part of the mix in the discussion, have open data, open dialogue, and move forward from there.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Engwell. I share your enthusiasm for working with DNR to try to ensure some consistently happy deer hunters in Minnesota. So we'll see what we can do in that regard. Any questions at this stage? All right. Well, we appreciate your testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to speak to this issue right here today? We do have an agenda we'd like to make our way through. So if not, we would transition to our next discussion item. All right. If we could call DNR back up to the table and just transition to speaking about fish populations in brief. And obviously, members, there's a lot that could be said on any one of these topics that could take, will keep us here well into the night, but we just wanted a brief overview on a couple of these important issues today.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Don Pereira, Fisheries Chief with the DNR. And I want to thank you and committee members for the opportunity to come and present information on plans that are coming together to try to reform how we manage northern pike statewide. With me is Gary Barnard, who's our area manager up in Bemidji. And we have an internal pike technical committee that's doing a lot, been doing a lot of work on this over the past couple of years. We've also been working with our stakeholders as well. Gary made a presentation at our annual stakeholder roundtable back in January. This will be a modified version of that. So, you know, unlike Muskellunge, we manage Muskellunge in a little over 100 water bodies around the state. Purely a trophy animal. Northern pike is, as you know, ubiquitous in Minnesota. We manage them in over 3,000 water bodies, and they very much are a fish for harvest. There certainly is a trophy aspect of northern pike fishing, but we certainly recognize the value of northern pike as a fish that a lot of anglers can catch, and also it's a fish to eat. The problem is that the dynamics of this species, particularly in the north central part of the state, have gotten to the point where excessive reproduction has resulted in stunting, small size, and now a lot of those populations are, not only are they suboptimal for harvest, they're also causing significant ecological problems for other fish species, notably walleye and panfish. So this problem has been going on for a long time. We've documented a trend that you will see that's been going on for four decades now in the north central part of the state. We've attempted to do other work in the past. Gary's going to talk a little bit about the history, but it's time now for us to really put much more emphasis on trying to solve the problem. It is going to require that all of our stakeholders, whether it's anglers or dark house spearers, perhaps look at some restrictive regulations to try to correct the problem. So with that, I'm going to hand the floor over to Gary.
All right, sir, if you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Gary Barnard. I'm an area fisheries supervisor in Bemidji, and as Don mentioned, I've been working on the Pike Technical Committee for some time. I'm going to talk about northern pike here in quite a bit of detail. So just to focus on the pike problem itself, it kind of starts with the loss of quality pike fishing opportunity, but that's just the beginning of it, as Don stated. This isn't about trophy pike management. This is about the populations and the entire fish community. So when you lose your big pike in your populations and things start to shift, population size structure shifts quite a bit, you end up with these high densities of small pike. And then you get the biological effects on the rest of the fish community, which can really impact stocked walleye, for example, fingerlings being stocked. Loss of the perch forage that walleyes need and other fish need as well, and then stunted panfish populations can even result from that. So the big question is, Minnesota infested with small pike? And we've been talking about this at fisheries roundtables for a long time. This was our 25th year of fisheries roundtables, and I think the small pike issue has been on the agenda quite a few of those years. In fact, in 2001, 15 years ago, we reviewed statewide regulations for a variety of species. It resulted in some bag limit reductions and stuff around the state for some species. But the result of that was a proposal for a statewide 24 to 40-inch protected slot limit for northern pike. And that was a very aggressive proposal at the time, and it certainly would have improved pike quality. The question was, would the improved quality offset the loss of harvest opportunity? And in the public review process, no, it didn't. It was viewed as overly restrictive, and that harvest opportunity for pike is very important as well. So that did not pass that process. So DNR kind of changed the course of management, went to individual lake management for northern pike, using our special experimental regulation process. It's good because you can fit the regulation directly to the water, and it's been proven pretty effective, but there's also the loss of harvest opportunity when you do that. Anytime you protect a size range of fish, you lose some harvest opportunity. I think the upside of that is mitigated because there's other lakes in the area people can go to. If you want to harvest fish, you go to this lake. If you want quality, you can go to another lake. But there was concern about the number of lakes falling under experimental regulations, and that's currently capped at 100 lakes, so we can't use that tool any longer for any more lakes. So it was kind of coming down to a standoff between quality and harvest in pike management. And we made some small gains by, you know, providing quality in like 100 lakes, but there, as Don mentioned, there's 3,000 pike lakes in the state that still had these problems with size structure, high densities of small pike, and those biological effects. So the question is, what's wrong with the existing statewide pike regulation? Why doesn't that work? As you know, it's a 3-fish daily bag with a 1 over 30 daily. When we looked at our creel information across the state for many years, 22,000 creel interviews, only about 1% ever harvest a limit of pike. So that bag limit isn't protecting any pike at all. And the 1 over 30 inch regulation, the encounter of a large pike is pretty rare these days. The encounter of two or more in a day is exceptionally rare, so that regulation isn't having much effect either. And it's actually kind of the ultimate feel-good regulation because everybody likes it because it doesn't really impact their harvest. And we can all feel good because we can say we're protecting large pike, but we're really not. So that regulation's been pretty ineffective. So we're looking for a better statewide regulation to manage pike, and that was kind of what the committee was tasked with. We looked at everything under the sun, minimum size limits, expanded bag limits, annual limits, harvest tags, and a variety of things. And the most obvious thing when we were starting to look at pike populations across the state is there's vast differences in the populations. They're not all acting the same way, not in the various areas of the state. They're unique fisheries characteristics, there's different management objectives, and there is no one-size-fits-all regulation for pike management in Minnesota. The map up here behind me shows pike density, and the red dots, if you can focus on those are the exceptionally high pike density, the real problem lakes. Blue dots are also pretty high, that's 5 to 10 pike per gill net lift, which is a pretty high density. And if you can see the gray dots, if they don't blend in there too much, those gray dots are kind of where you'd want to see pike density, down less than 5 per gill net lift. Around 7 per net lift is when you start having problems with walleye fingerling stocking and not being very effective. So those high density populations are driving some other management as well. You can see where that really the concentration of red and blue dots are in the north central part of the state. That's kind of the problem area there. So what about a zone concept for managing northern pike in Minnesota? And we talked about this. It's really not one size fits all, like I mentioned. So the template exists for game management to have different zones and have different regulations. It's less complex than individual lake management, and you can customize the regs to where they work the best. So what our technical committee is recommending is actually 3 distinct pike management zones in the state. Let's talk about those zones. The northeast management zone, that's kind of the Arrowhead region up there that didn't have a lot of the red dots, a lot of gray dots. Pretty low densities, they got moderate recruitment. That's new fish coming into the population. Good growth and survival. They don't have a lot of harvest up there because they've got a lot of lakes for the population base that they've got, and they still produce large pike up there. So that the objectives for that zone would be just to continue to provide harvest opportunity and really focus protection on large pike. The recommendation there is a maximum size limit where you wouldn't harvest fish over 30 inches. That gives you the protection of the large trophy pike. And the two fish bag limit of fish under 30 provides a lot of harvest potential for shore lunches and that type of thing. The southern management zone, again, it's a whole different pike population down there. Very low abundance. It's got poor reproduction. A lot of the good spawning habitat's gone in the southern area. Exceptional growth on young pike. Pretty high fishing pressure down there. There's not a lot of lakes, and there's a lot of population base down there. So they got a lot of high pressure and a high turnover on the pike population. So high harvest relative to pike abundance. So down there, the objectives are good. Actually the reverse. You want to increase pike abundance down there. There's stocking of pike going on down there to increase abundance and improve harvest opportunity. So why not put on a minimum size limit there to actually utilize that fast growth, keep them in the population a little bit longer, and get them up to a little bit larger size before they're harvested. Two fish bag limit over a 24-inch minimum, for example, would produce a lot more yield per pike down there. So that's the proposal for that zone. And then the north central management zone, which is a lot more complicated. That's the one with the density issues that's having the big effects on the fish community. We've got the high recruitment and high density populations down there and very slow growth because of the high density. So pike are starting to stunt in those lakes or have been stunting for quite some time. Slow growth, moderate to high fishing pressure, but it's targeted at the higher the size ranges. So you see, as pike get into those medium sizes, they get harvested pretty quickly, and very few fish are achieving large size in the north central zone, most of those lakes. This chart shows the increase in pike abundance that's been occurring since the 70s, and it's pretty significant there. You can see it was averaging down around 4 per gill net lift back in the 70s, and we're up in that 6 to 7 per gill net lift on average in the north central zone now. And that is that kind of that problem threshold for having effects on the community. So the objectives for the north central zone are to reduce small pike abundance and restore or improve size distribution and try to increase recruitment to those larger size ranges to some extent. But we have to remember that, you know, we could do that with the experimental type regs we have now, but we have to maintain or improve harvest opportunity. We can't give up on harvest opportunity as well. That's important to anglers and spearers alike. So our options are an expanded bag limit that would put pressure on small fish, have the anglers actually targeting more small fish. That would increase harvest opportunity right there if we expanded the bag limit. And would encourage removal of those. But expanded bag limits, we've done quite a bit of experimenting with them in the past, and they haven't been very effective on their own in shifting size distribution like we would like. And I'll talk about that here as to why that hasn't worked very well. This is a typical size distribution of northern pike across the north central zone. And this is taken from multiple lake surveys of lakes, experimental gillnet samples. And you can see the pike piled up there in the 16 to 22-inch size ranges. Lots of small fish, no surprise there. And the red line there is kind of the distinguishing line between small and medium pike, and that isn't arbitrarily set. That's kind of the tipping point where anglers under 22, they release most of the pike that they catch. When they get over 22, they start to harvest most of the pike that they catch. So that's a real defined line there. And you can see the decline in abundance getting through the medium size ranges. The dotted red line is about when fish, you know, that's a little more arbitrary. That's the distinction between medium and large, but that we'll talk about that a little more too. But what What isn't apparent on this graph, that peak in size distribution there at 18 to 20 inches or 22 inches, that's kind of when these fish are growing into our gear as well. There's a lot of fish to the left of that curve that you're not seeing, and those are the age 0, age 1, and age 2 pike that are in even higher abundance than what you're seeing there, and they're waiting to replace those 18 to 22 inch pike. So that's why it's really not so efficient to remove those by anglers, because there's a lot of fish just waiting. It's kind of a moving target. So we really need some suppression from those medium-sized pike, medium to large pike. And the reason suppression may work better than anglers removing them is because they'll target pike all the way down to age 0, 1, and 2, mm-hmm. stuff that anglers won't even look at. So actually thinning the crop before they ever get to that size. So what's necessary is some protection of bigger fish in that population to exert density suppression on small fish. And that's what's been lost, is that abundance of medium to large fish. The photo here is it's an indication of that density dependent stuff. The small pike in the picture there actually came from the inside that larger pike. But it's kind of a misconception that you need large pike to do this job. That's only a 25-inch pike on the measuring board there that's consuming about a 17-inch pike. So those medium pike can consume a lot of small fish, and a lot of those even smaller fish, the 6 to 8 to 10-inch fish that haven't recruited to the population yet. So that's where, you know, we think there's a lot of value in those medium sizes. If you were to put some protection on the large fish here in the size distribution, you're not protecting very many fish at all. And so very few fish aren't going to have a lot of density effect on the smaller fish in that population. We really need to harvest or to look at protecting some medium fish. And the next slide shows that you can carve out just a very narrow size range there, a 4-inch size range from 22 to 26 inches that will protect 62% of those fish over over medium size. So you don't really don't need to protect as aggressively as we were with some of our experimental regulations. And what that does is it allows some harvest opportunity above the slot. So the recommendation for the North Central is a 10-fish expanded bag below on the small fish, below 22 inches. Anglers could take all they want below that size range and not going to impact the population. And it's going to help, and it's going to provide some additional opportunity for a surplus fish that we have plenty of. Then you protect that very narrow size range there to get to build that population, that part of the population, up to get some more suppression on small fish, and then allow two fish over 26 for that important harvest opportunity, keep that available. And those are going to be nice fish. Now you're talking 5.5, 6-pound fish that are growing into that harvest range at that point. So it's something for anglers and spears to gain from it as well. So kind of summarize there, the 10-fish expanded bag limit, it provides that harvest opportunity and helps to reduce abundance below. The narrow 22 to 26 is the part that really puts the suppression on small fish. Stockpile some fish in those size ranges to do that. And then the two fish over 26 improves the harvest opportunity above. So in the whole picture, in the three zones, what are the expectations? In the Northeast, not a lot of improvement needed and not much expected. That's just to maintain the existing quality up there. The southern zone would have almost immediate results. Those fish grow quickly. Within a year or two, you'd be pushing more fish out over 24 inches into a better harvest opportunity. And the north central is kind of a mix of the two. There'd be gradual moderate shifts in size distribution, but it won't take near as long as some of those more aggressive slot limits. And it will start to push some fish out through the top of that slot. Within 4 or 5 years to improve that harvest opportunity. So not a big turnaround on that for time. So with that, any questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Bernard. That was very helpful. We really appreciate that thorough overview here. If you could just just restate or confirm your hope that what in terms of what this would do for walleye populations, for instance, on Mille Lacs.
Well, this regulation is probably the zone concept probably wouldn't fit Mille Lacs because Mille Lacs is managed under special pike regulations. So
sure. You
can do some things. We've got a number of those lakes that are under special reg, like Upper Red Lake. In Mille Lacs, those would have their own regs that you can kind of fit to the lake. This would be more of a broad region-wide regulation that's going to generally help populations across that whole north-central region. But as far as walleye stocking, we stock a lot of those small lakes across the north-central area. We're pouring a lot of walleye fingerlings and a lot of walleye fry in there that are getting consumed by small pike. And the data is showing that once you get up in those higher pike densities that we're not achieving the goals that we're shooting for walleye management. So it would definitely help to reduce those numbers.
So this isn't the silver bullet for Lake Mille Lacs, but it could have great impact on walleye populations around that region.
Certainly.
All right, very good. Any other questions from the committee here?
Mr. Chair, if I
yes,
could
please.
I just make just a couple of quick closing comments. We're still wrapping up our technical work. It's just about done. But also, I wanted your committee to be aware that we have quite a bit planned for the coming year to work with our stakeholders. We have an outreach and marketing program for this problem that we're just putting that together now. We're going to start that this spring. We also do regular human dimension surveys with social scientists over at the University of Minnesota, and we're actually going to have them starting right away this spring do a targeted survey on our pike anglers and also dark roe spearers to find out what their values and preferences are so we can do a better job at incorporating what their preferences are and try to solve this problem. So those are pretty important activities that we're going to be doing during this calendar year. So hopefully by next legislative session, we'll be ready for a bill that we think will give us the best chance at hopefully solving this problem.
Well, very good. Well, we appreciate the preview here today. We know this is a challenge out there, and we wish you the best in the process that's going to unfold here in the months ahead. No other questions? We do have a couple of other testifiers who'd like to speak to this general issue. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee. Bye.
Welcome to committee, sir. If you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of Anglers for Habitat. And I have with me Mr. Jim Lilienthal, one of our members who is our chairman of our Habitat Committee. I'm going to make a few opening remarks.
Absolutely.
And then turn it over to Jim.
All right, proceed.
We wish to submit our support for changes to the fishing regulations that you've just heard regarding bag limits for small northern pike. Through our membership, Mr. Lilienthal here, the chair of our Habitat Committee, has undertaken a study of more than 1,000 lakes on his own time and his own dime. Regarding northern pike populations, this study shows trends of stunted or hammer-handled northern pike are overpopulated and causing some disruption in the fisheries of our lakes. More small northern pike equal less bait fish and less walleye reproduction, even on stocked lakes. We believe that adjusting the bag limits on small northern pike upwards of 10 per bag limit, less than 22 inches, we can help you ease this problem. This will require some encouragement from the public as a whole to change the mindset that these fish are worth keeping and consuming. It will take some time to change the public's view. This we realize, and through Anglers for Habitat, we will do as much public awareness as we possibly can to encourage better fishing for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding with your remarks.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Lilienthal, and I'm a retired DNR Fisheries Area Supervisor. And I've worked with this northern pike problem for over 30 years. It's been frustrating, to say the least. Started seeing some of the experimental and special regulations going into effect that we were really on our way towards being able to do some good management. But as was explained earlier, that it ran into some conflict with harvest-oriented anglers and spear fishermen. And that's what's so unique about this new proposal is it's for the first time it is really combined looking at these two things. The need for having a larger size pike to be able to eat some of these smaller pike in these populations is critical. But it's also a resource that's out there that has been utilized at times in the past. I think I kind of disagree a little bit with some of the previous surveys that were done. They were done quite a while ago. I think the last ones were from 1998. And the problem has gotten considerably worse since then. When the regulations did change a few years ago, I think in 2011, it was pretty disappointing to me that the long-range plan was now, there's a 20-year long-range plan that was focusing on getting larger fish, which the anglers had asked us for. And what ended up happening is that ended up being limited to, in 2011, to 100 lakes. When you, as was mentioned earlier, there's about 3,200 lakes outside of that, under the current statewide regulation. What I wanted to do when I started looking at this was look at these lakes and see if I could define some impacts. In fact, even define the numbers that existed out there, because there wasn't a lot of discussion on the numbers of these small fish. I looked at 1,004 walleye lakes. I got my information from Lake Finder. It's available to everybody from the DNR. And I looked at three-year classes of stocking of walleye and had, from that, I feel I had probably pretty close to doing 90 and 95% of the walleye lakes in Minnesota, or the, not walleye lakes, but the lakes receiving walleye stocking in Minnesota. What really quickly became apparent to me in my first go-through was that the North Central area, as described earlier, was a real problem area. I had a little bit different methodology that I used on this. Again, I looked at strictly the lakes stocked with walleye. I came back later and I looked at lakes that were over 500 acres. And I wanted to be sure I had the best of the best lakes that I was looking at. And I started recording things like the percent of northern pike that were captured in surveys that were less than 24 inches long. The perch gill net catches, which was alluded to earlier too, the perch populations are in terrible shape in these lakes that have had these high density pike populations. In fact, I've got a category of less than two perch, and it's one of the highest categories of lakes within these bigger walleye lakes. And it makes a huge difference in not only the survival of the walleye, because they're eating the perch. The perch are the main buffer species. They're even more important as a buffer to northern pike predation than they are as a prey species in these central lakes. Walleye is very capable of surviving on a lot of different small fish. But it's important to have these perch in an abundance to be able to shelter them from our stocking. I've stocked millions of walleye fingerlings and fry in my career, and it really bothered me to see that we weren't going to get more than 100 lakes out of 3,200 that we're going to probably get some advantage out of a lot of the work that had been done. So this is why I brought it up at the roundtable last year and suggested some things like zones and also that this central zone was a primary point of action that needed action. 93% of the problem pike lakes are located in that north central region. And I've got examples of many different counties where I've gone in. Lake Finder is set up on a county by county basis, so that's kind of how I put my figures together. And I look at a county like Otter Tail County, which has some of the best fisheries out there and has the greatest number of walleye that are stocked. 81 lakes receive walleye. At least 81 lakes receive some sort of management with walleye stocking in that county. 51 of those lakes are over 500 acres. The average was about 1,900 acres each. So these are not small basins that we're talking about here. And 23 of those 51 lakes had perch populations of 2 or less. The average was 0.96 perch per gill net. On those 23 lakes, again, that's 46% of the large lakes in Otter Tail County. Now, it's... when you look at those things that way, and when you look at the sizes, the other thing I wanted to say about that, the average percentage of northern pike that were less than 24 inches long was 96% on those lakes with two. So you don't have food to feed these pike. They have slow growth rates anyhow. And there is just no future for those pike unless something happens to that to lower those numbers of small pike. And at the same time, in those same lakes with two, the average walleye per gill net catch, which is actually kind of high for the lakes in that central region, was about 5 per gill net. I also looked at those that were over 10 perch per gill net. There, the average percentage of northern pike larger than 24 inches was 25% compared to 6% in the ones with a few. So the perch make an absolutely huge thing. I'm trying to look at this like community-based management. The other part was with those walleye, the average walleye gill net catch in the lakes with over 10 perch out there was 11.75 walleye per gill net compared to between 4 and 5 per gill net in those lakes that had just 2. And it gets worse as you go east. You get into some of these smaller lakes, some of these lakes with have had a long history of cabins around the lake and have and high harvest rates for northern pike. In Crow Wing County, Crow Wing may be one of the worst counties. There, over 70% of the stocked walleye lake have greater than 7 per gill net. And I grew up in those lakes, spent over 60 years on the whitefish chain, and I can recall in my fishing out there bringing home limits that averaged over 7 pounds consistently. So I was part of the problem. And the other, but now when we go out there, I fish contests out there for years that include northern pike. And we had 3 fish limits coming in at the last contest I was at that weighed between 4.5 and 6 pounds for three fish. When I first started out there, the average would have been close to 7 pounds apiece on that. And it was, if you were going to be in the top 10 in that, it would have been probably a three fish limit of well over 20 pounds. So it's the change has been just dramatic.
All right, well, I have a lot of family in the Crow Wing County area, and I've heard these stories firsthand, so I don't know if I had the success that you had in your past fishing, but
if you want to look at some of the data that I've got, and it's obscene with the numbers of lakes that have over 90% of their northern pike that are under 24 inches long.
Sure.
So I'm really hoping that we can move forward with this. It is good for everybody.
Sure. Yeah, it seems like
nobody that doesn't gain from this happening.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of interest in picking up this topic from the roundtables and other stakeholders. So I would encourage DNR to proceed as they've suggested today, and I hope a wide variety of stakeholders will stay involved as those conversations move forward. And we may be back here next year in this very room talking about this. Who knows? And with some concrete items in our bill.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah. Are there any questions from the committee members? Well, at this stage in the game, thank you very much for your testimony. We will spend the next 15 minutes or so just previewing a DNR agency bill, if we could. Senate File 1303. Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this out. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right. So if DNR would mind reapproaching the table and speaking to what you can on Senate File 1303, which was just introduced, and this is the agency policy bill. And I understand if we don't get to all of it today, we can always pick it up on Wednesday. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Kathy Don Carlos. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife.
All right, proceed.
Mr. Chair, do you mind if I turn off the projector?
Absolutely.
It's a little bit
of
competition.
We can hear it from here, so. Help is on the way.
Just use a hammer, it'll go.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. The Game and Fish Bill this year that you have in front of you, Senate File 1303, is actually a combination of technical and policy initiatives related to game and fish management and enforcement. And so Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith is here to help just do the quick overview. And if you have any detailed questions, because you so skillfully arranged to have our leadership from fisheries and wildlife sections here for presentations, they can perhaps help answer any more in-depth questions that you have. But you do have a fact sheet in your packets, which summarizes the Game and Fish Bill. And Lieutenant Colonel and I will walk through this section by section with a pretty high overview. So beginning with Section 1, this provision would allow the agency to use the expedited permanent rulemaking process to be used for potentially all fish and wildlife rulemaking, resulting in a more efficient establishment of season regulations on an annual basis. Currently, our existing authority to use expedited permanent rulemaking is limited to describing zones or permit areas, designating fish spawning beds, selecting hunters and anglers, providing for registration, preventing diseases, and correcting errors. Working on about 11 different rule packages since 2008, we've heard from our stakeholders that for non-controversial rulemaking packages, they would like to see those enacted quicker than the permanent rulemaking process allows. We would only propose to use this for changes that aren't contentious or have diverse support for, and in fact, public hearing would be automatically in play if 100 people or more requested it. So this would really help the agency be more effective in its rulemaking processes. We would still use the permanent rulemaking process for those very highly visible contentious issues. The second and third sections of the Game and Fish Bill have to do with WMA and AMA acquisitions, and it would eliminate the state obligation to pay relocation costs to landowners selling land to us for those two types of outdoor recreation units when they have dwellings on them. Most of the land that we acquire for WMAs and AMAs do not have dwellings on them, and in fact, we typically avoid purchasing land with dwellings on them because of the uncertainty that we're exposed to as an agency when we acquire lands that way. After DNR and the landowner signs an agreement on the acquisition, that's when the actual relocation discussions start. So we've signed a purchase agreement, or I'm not coming up, that's not the right term, but we've kind of signed an intent to purchase without knowing what relocation costs the landowner may want. Most of the time, landowners selling land to us with dwellings on it do not ask for relocation because we're not condemning land. This is a transaction that involves willing landowners. So this provision would eliminate that obligation to pay relocation costs. The second part of the revisions in sections 2 and 3 is really a technical fix. Currently, we pay landowners up to $1,500 for appraisals that they may do independently, and this would just provide that in clearer language in those sections of statute. Sections 4 and 30 are actually focused on allowing bait harvest from infested waters, and this was initiated by catfish anglers who were interested in harvesting gizzard shad on portions of the Mississippi and St. Croix rivers that are currently identified as infested waters using cast nets. Cast nets are not a legal method of take right now for game fish, and this would allow us to issue permits to use cast nets for harvesting gizzard shad to be used on those same waters. And so it reduces the exposure of risk for moving around in invasive species. There's a provision, because this is such a new technique and we don't have a lot of biological data on it, there is a provision for it to expire in 2017 at the end of the calendar year with a requirement for the agency to report in 3 months on the conservation impacts of this change and other details like number of permits issued and so forth. But this does reflect a several-year discussion that we've had with catfish angler interests in those areas. Moving on, Section 5 is a technical change that would allow the agency clear authority to close access to areas that have, for instance, diseased waterfowl in it. And currently the statute says that we need to do it by emergency rule, which takes several weeks. We're requesting that we can be in compliance by just posting the accesses with explanations about why. This is a practice that we have been doing to protect domestic livestock rearing operations throughout the state from wildlife diseases that can spread to domestic animals or to humans. Section 6 is a technical provision. Our Game and Fish Fund Budget Oversight Committee sunsets on June 30th, 2015, and we've come back about every 5 years to have this expiration date extended, and this provision would extend it another 5 years. Section 7 has to do with our federal aid and wildlife risks and sport fish restoration compliance. This is a federal law or act that allows the agency to qualify for federal allotments of funding, but there's very strict provisions about how the Game and Fish Fund and license dollars are appropriated in order to remain in compliance with this federal act. And this would specify that appropriations for IT purposes be made to the commissioner, and then the commissioner pay Minute, in this case, for those services rather than have the appropriation go directly to Minute. If that were the case, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would find us not in compliance with the federal act, and our the $16 to $35 million that we receive annually from Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson funds would be in jeopardy.
Mr. Chair, for the record,
yes,
Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, Sections 8 and 9 are to get us up to the 20th century on issuing citations. We are just unrolling our records management system, and you can see current law says that we need to issue citations in quadruplicate. We'll be doing electronic citations, so we just want to get the language up to current practice. Same with Section 9. Section 10 is going to allow county attorneys in two different counties to prosecute a violation under one county. Where this would come into play is if somebody had an over limit of fish in their house in Ramsey County and they had a cabin in Cass County, currently you'd have to charge those two offenses in two separate counties. This would allow it to charge it in one county in aggregate. Section 11, Section 11, 12, 14, 15, 24, 25, and 35. There's a lot of pieces to this, but basically what we're doing are two things, and I'll run through those quick so we don't have to go through every one of those sections. There's been a substantial cottage industry popping up over the last few years where people are bringing fur that they've trapped to an individual in the round, and then that person will skin them, flesh them, put them up for the person for pay. And what we're proposing in this legislation is to, for that person that does that for compensation, to have a $10 license to do that, so we have some inspection authority for those folks and are able to go in there and make sure that everything's on the up and up. So this is just for compensation, so you could still do it for a neighbor or somebody else, but without compensation you wouldn't need the $10 license. The other part of that fur preparation, buying and selling, is after certain species of fur are registered, such as pine marten, bobcat, otter, and other CITES animals, once they're registered through the DNR, there are people that will drive around in big trucks and collect all the fur from people to send them to the auction up in Canada. And right now there's no license required for it because technically they're not purchasing those furs. They're just acting kind of as an intermediate. And so this would require that person to have some type of license again. So we do have some inspection authority. So when we see a large truck full of fur, we have the opportunity, if there's some reason to go in there and do some type of inspection because they are protected species. So that's what that whole cadre of sections do in part and pieces. So,
and do you mind just repeating which sections those are?
It'd be Section 11, 12, yep, 14, 15, 24, 25, and 35. It should be on your fact sheet, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
All those sections. So.
Oh, sure. All right. I see it now. Thank you.
Yes. Section 13 is to do a little bit of clarification on landowner turkey license preferences. Current law says that that a 20% of the licenses are eligible for those people that own and live on property and their family members. And what we'd like to do is make that a little bit clear, that those are family members who live on the qualifying land. There are some families larger than others, and we're getting many adult children and then their children and second cousins who are all family members, but they don't live on the qualifying land, and so they're all getting into this landowner eligibility drawing because of the way that the law is written. So we just want to clarify that you have to live on that land in order to be qualified as a family member.
And you have swine on 16. So, Mr. Chair, Senators, Section 16 has to do with feral swine. And this would prohibit the possession, release, hunting, or trapping of feral swine. Feral swine are a major problem for the state for several reasons. They host many parasites and diseases that threaten humans, domestic livestock, and wildlife. They also cause extensive damage where they get established to natural systems, to forest, ag lands, native plant communities, and water resources. They're a growing threat in the United States, and they've got the attention of USDA. Minnesota does not have any established populations of feral swine as nearby states do, like Michigan, but they're a huge threat, and we've got some gaps in our laws that limit our ability to respond if there are feral swine in the state.
Senator Osmick, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, if they're a problem, why would you prohibit hunting, trapping? I would understand prohibiting the possession and release. I don't know why you'd want to possess a feral swine. but I don't quite comprehend why we wouldn't want to have a no-bag limit, take-them-all type of approach.
Ms. Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, that's an excellent question that other states have grappled with, and USDA has found that those states that do allow hunting or trapping actually can't get on top of their feral swine problem. And what's more effective is to have a very focused eradication program. Hunting and trapping just doesn't focus it enough quickly enough or with enough force. So USDA has advised states to really be wary of that approach.
Thank you. If you'd like to proceed. And we are running out of time here, so maybe if there's a natural break point for you, as much as I'd love to get through the whole bill today, I recognize we have three of our members absent now, so it might be good to pick this up on Wednesday. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing today? Or?
Mr. Chair, could I just talk about Section 17 because there are some people here?
You absolutely can, yes.
Mr. Chair, we've asked, or we're going to be asking the author to delete that from the bill. We put that in as a placeholder, and we haven't been able to, and we failed to get all the parties to the table. So we're going to be asking that is deleted from the bill, and then we could pick up then Wednesday, Mr. Chair.
All right. That sounds good. I had heard that Section 17 was not intended to be included in this draft. So thank you for mentioning that. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, just because it's something on my list in case I'm not available for the next hearing on this, Section 22, prohibiting of luring and feeding of owls. I'd like to talk about that just briefly because I do have some individuals in my district that that take photography pictures of, and they use luring in order to get the owls to be able to take pictures of them. And this would specifically prohibit them from doing something that I think they even make money, that they use as an enterprise. So I guess I got some problems here, unless you can explain to me exactly what the purpose of this is, because I don't necessarily think there's probably a lot of people out there luring them to shoot them for any good reason.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, Section 22 is the result of a bunch of activities that happened last winter where these owls flew down from the north because there was I think they were the Great Grays. Is that what they were? And they were stressed because they had to come to Minnesota to find food. And so they came down into Minnesota, quite a population of them, and there were a number of people that used all kinds of different methods to lure them to get good pictures of them. And the concern is a couple. Number one, they're not native to to an area where there's populations of people or vehicles. So many of these people were taking pictures by side of the road, and these owls would swoop in and were almost getting hit by cars. The other concern they had was that these animals were stressed to begin with. and that they had to come down here to find food, and that they were using the last bit of energy they had to swoop down and get things that weren't food, and that was adding more stress to them, and they were probably flying away and having some mortality. So this is a result. There was some legislation at the end of last session that didn't quite make it through, so this was the department's commitment was to go back and work on this over the interim and come back this year with something to address that issue.
Yeah, Mr. Rosbeck. Then, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then you acknowledged right up front that last winter was a very unusual winter, that obviously this winter is not the same as last winter. Do you think that this is a little bit maybe of a knee-jerk reaction to one bad winter as opposed to something that seems to be an ongoing problem?
Please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosbeck, I'm not the non-game specialist, but I know that in the conversations that we have had that this happens on a semi-regular basis. It happens every few years depending on the weather conditions. So this year might not be as bad, but we don't know what next winter could bring. And I could definitely get you the experts from our non-game section to have the conversation with you, sir, because they know a lot more about it than I do, sir.
Sir Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be okay with speaking with them. I would make a suggestion before we move forward on this particular section that there needs to be, maybe there is some licensure or some angle that you could take with professional people who are professionals that are taking pictures that can have some kind of a license that says what they can and cannot do. Sort of, we have many licenses in Minnesota, and there's many stipulations to getting said licenses that they have to follow. For photographers, they have to follow the following protocols, and they would be able to be provided a license at an incredibly nominal fee to be able to still do what they do, which is in some cases may professionally be gaining from. That allows them to know what the rules of the road are, and that you can get the bad actors weeded out. That I think that's what you're really trying to do.
Ms. Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, there is a provision in the current language that would allow people to get permits. This doesn't exclude someone that gets a permit from Fish and Wildlife Service or even us to issue it. So I think that's compatible with your suggestion about a license. It just is taking the permit route instead of a license.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, thank you for pointing that out. Definitely, if you can put some additional comfort language in there that allows people, that we can make it more specific, because I'm sure I'm going to have my email clicking with a couple of different people very soon once they realize that provision is in there. At least something that's spelled out, and also it'd be nice to know what that fee is going to be, so that they have some comfort in what's going to be coming down the pike.
Well, very good. Well, this might be a good point for us to set this bill aside and pick it up when we meet this Wednesday, again at 4 p.m. in this room. Thank you for your interest in discussing these items today, and this committee is adjourned.
Yeah, that the owl thing we discussed that extensively.
We never heard anything.
No, that was a big discussion in the house.
Okay. So you got friends who are photographers?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks.
Yeah,
appreciate your help here.
I've seen you. Obviously, coming to talk to Senator Schmidt, but thanks for finally meeting you.
Thanks, ma'am. I'm going to run to that caucus, so if you don't mind, clean it up.
Yeah.
Just, you could either set this on my desk, or it's whatever.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. All right. I got a jet. Thanks a lot.
I'm going to leave my stuff in my
over. That's fine. That's what I did too, Craig. The new stuff.
Why don't back and forth?
You just want me to stuff the folders?
Okay, Monday. We don't want to change the weather committee folders.
No, stuff the materials.
Now they took that back out.
Yeah.
I would say so.
Okay. I mean, this is the agenda.
Who's this?
It's going to be
something. Okay.
But she's a journalist. She might just need that. But, like.
No, I would say.
All right, well, I'm sorry to not.
I was hoping you'd get a chance to testify just to get everybody
shared, let them out that it's working. Well, I mean, nobody's complaining. I mean, absolutely nobody.
Bob said they had no complaints.
Well, then let's just leave it alone, boys and girls. We just went through this fight.
Yeah.